Welcome back to the Fitz News Studios for another edition of The Week in Review. We got a lot to cover this week on Stephen Smith. This news outlet has released additional case files related to this ongoing murder investigation. We're going to give you the very latest on that investigation and let you hear from some of those audio interviews that we released this week. In addition to that, a big update on judicial reform, a major push from the South Carolina prosecutorial and law enforcement community, unfortunately, for some minor reform. We're going to get into that in detail. Also, a real treat, we sat down with Candace Carroll of Americans for Prosperity to get an update on what's happening, or more specifically, not happening this year at the South Carolina State House. So be on the lookout for that and much more on your Week in Review. So we wondered in the aftermath of Alec Murdoch's double homicide trial, what would be the big Murdoch-related story that would drive the narrative in the weeks to come? Well, we found out pretty quickly. Stephen Smith. Folks, this story has exploded in the last few weeks. In fact, just this weekend, Fox News with a huge report on the latest developments in the ongoing investigation into the murder of Stephen Smith. Now, if you haven't followed this story, Stephen Smith, 19-year-old from Hampton, South Carolina, his body was found in the middle of Sandy Run Road in Hampton County in the early morning hours of July 8, 2015. His death initially misclassified as a hit and run, but it drew international attention when it was featured prominently in the Netflix documentary Murdoch Murders, A Southern Scandal. Now, Smith's death gained notoriety after the state law enforcement division here in South Carolina opened a homicide investigation in the aftermath of the double homicide for which Alec Murdoch was convicted earlier this month. Now, as we know, SLED opened that investigation based on obtaining a copy of a Highway Patrol report which detailed all of the inconsistencies in the investigation surrounding Smith's murder. Now, that report is one of several documents that this news outlet has been releasing over the last 2 weeks in an effort to give the public a firsthand look at the details of this investigation. The Stephen Smith case, folks, it has turned from a cold case into sort of a sporting event where people on different sides seem to be rooting for different outcomes. And our goal in putting all this information out for you to see is to look at what we've been looking at as we've been trying to find the truth about this investigation, no matter where that truth goes. Again, some seem to be pushing agendas on this story. Our goal from the very beginning has just been to find out what happened. So as we've done that, we've been releasing this information. And the report that we released, the South Carolina Highway Patrol MATE report, they call it, the Multi-Accident Investigation Team, that's what it stands for. And the Highway Patrol got this case, again, because it was initially misclassified as a hit and run. Smith's body found in the middle of this road, gaping wound to the head, but not a wound consistent with a vehicular strike. Also, there was no evidence, vehicular debris, of tire tracks, of skid marks, of anything of that nature, nothing to suggest a vehicular strike. So, as we've dug into this story, there's been significant speculation surrounding Murdoch connections. And in fact, the Murdoch name is all over this report. And in just a minute, we're going to talk about how the persons of interest in this case, which were exclusively reported on by this news outlet this week, there are still Murdoch ties to those individuals. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. But first, I wanted to get into some of the files that we released this week. Audio interviews that were conducted by Highway Patrol investigators in the immediate aftermath of this story, because as I've said, you know, a cold case, you know, here's why they call it a cold case, because a crime scene, it's kind of like a stove. You turn the stove off and immediately everything from that moment starts to get colder. Everything is harder to identify, tougher to find. And in fact, investigators are learning that the hard way as they dig into this investigation. But we wanted to go back to those early interviews because I felt like it's important to find out what investigators were looking at in the hours and days after this murder took place. So one of the first interviews we found and that we published as part of our release of these files was an interview with Smith's sister, Stephanie Joyner. Now, if you read this news outlet, you know Stephanie Joyner, you know her name. She is actually connected very closely with a Murdoch family fixer, Greg Alexander. In fact, the two of them have a child together and all that unfolded in the aftermath of Stephen Smith's murder. Greg Alexander obviously becoming very close to Joyner and her family. But she gave an interview, and it's an interesting interview because in that conversation with investigators, she talked about reports that Stephen Smith was a homosexual male escort. Now, this news outlet has reported in the past that in the weeks leading up to his death, Smith was engaged in what could charitably be described as high-risk behavior. Well, we began to detail that in our latest coverage with some of these interviews, but when Smith was asked about it, if you listen to this conversation, you can clearly tell that she's dismissing that. And not only that, she talked about how if Smith was doing anything like that, that any money he made would have come back to the family. And I wanted to get zero in on that because it's significant. Let's cut to that interview with Stephanie Joyner.
Over the 2 weeks, did he give any indication who he may have been hanging out with? No. Did anybody that you know of know who he may have been hanging out with? Mm-mm. Now, I'm going to go back to some of the stuff about what Mark had said. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as over the 2 weeks, could he have met somebody other than Mark that you know of?
Well, Stephen wasn't really, put it this way, if he was talking to somebody, he would give them a different address if they wanted to send him stuff. Mm-hmm. So I don't get how him and Mark, you know, became close and stuff like that.
Okay.
Because,
And when you say give a different address, what do you mean by a different?
He would choose a house down the road and get the stuff sent there. That's how Stephen was.
Okay.
And, he wouldn't let people know where he lived. And if he did, you know, he'd be like down the road. Okay. That type thing.
All right. Now, do you know if, your brother was putting things on Craigslist or not?
I know he was putting some things, but not, I knew about all the gay app accounts he had,
right.
But other than anything personal, no.
Okay. All these gay app accounts, was he trying to meet people? And I'm not talking about just for money. Was he trying to meet people on these accounts? In other words, like a dating website.
It was more of a friend thing. Okay. He didn't really want anything, you know, too close and personal with these people. He just wanted somebody to talk to, and that's how he talked to all these people. But I always told him to leave all them people on the internet because he was going to mess with the wrong person and something was going to happen.
So one of the other interesting things about Stephanie Smith's interview is she's repeatedly challenging information provided to investigators by an individual named Mark Bickert. Now, Mark Bickert purports to have had a relationship with Stephen Smith. He says they were in love. In fact, he said they were going to get married. Bickert, much older than Smith, a former male escort himself, Bickert claimed that Smith was not only engaged in escorting, but that in fact, Stephanie Joyner knew about it. In fact, it was all on an iPad that Smith and Joyner had that they used together. Now, what's interesting about Bickert's testimony, though, or rather the information he provided investigators, is that he claims to have had knowledge of what happened to Smith literally moments before he was murdered. Specifically, he talks about Smith telling him that he had been harassed at a convenience store in between Walterboro and Alameda, South Carolina. Talks about a truck with mud tires coming up behind Smith, talks about Smith telling him that he'd run out of gas and that he was walking or that he thought he heard Smith walking down a roadside. In fact, let's cut to that segment because this is incredibly detailed information about what Bickert claims are the last moments of Stephen Smith's life. Let's give a listen.
All right, let me kind of go back. You're familiar about the incident where Stephen Smith died last Wednesday, is that correct?
Yeah.
All right. What I want you to do is when was the last time you talked to Stephen?
That night.
All right. About what time? Not the text, but about what time is the last time you talked to him?
You have to remember with all this, I took my Seroquel sometime. I can't remember if the call came.
I'm just asking for a roundabout time.
I can't remember if it came after the text or before the text because the last call I heard, I asked him on one of the calls, are you walking? Because he already told me he was running out of gas. One of the calls before, and I says, are you walking? Because I hear cars going by, and his answer to me was no. And then the call dropped, and I don't remember if he called me because we were back and forth. The calls kept dropping.
After the call, did you text him?
I mean, I don't remember. I mean, there were texts. I mean, we had so many texts back and forth that night on me worried about him calling me, you know. Phone servers out there, and with this phone right now, we're having issues with our phones. Right. And half the times, I don't have service.
Is that where he said he felt like he was being followed at?
Yes, he said that he was being harassed at that store.
By who?
He didn't say. He said it was a couple of guys in the pickup truck. If I call correctly, he said they were rednecks. But I know.
Did he ever give you a description of the pickup truck? He may or may not.
He said it was big and it was tall. He didn't give me a description with the mud tires. But the last time we talked that night, before the phone went down, and I said to him, "Are you working or not?" I called him back. Or was that before? I know at one point I heard mud tires. I heard big mud tires. Big mud tires. And I...
In other words, when you say you hear
in the background...
Are you hearing whining? Is that what you're trying to say? Like,
yeah, I hear the mud tires like they're coming towards him or coming, going past him. Because they sounded loud. That they were getting louder. And that, I believe, was the last time I talked to him.
All right, if you want to listen to all these interviews that we posted, in fact, there's another interview we posted with an individual who had what he claims is a consensual adult encounter with Stephen Smith, and we don't know all the specifics of that. He claims it was not a monetary transaction, but that interview is also posted. We also have an interview with Smith's mother, Sandy Smith, an audio interview that we posted. All those files and all the files that we've released available on fitsnews.com, so go check them out, fitsnews.com. But while we think about where this investigation is going, a couple of important items that we broke this week that bear mentioning here. First and most importantly, the State Law Enforcement Division's current investigation does appear to have zeroed in on two individuals as persons of interest in connection with Smith's death. And I'm referring to Patrick Wilson and Sean Connolly. These are two Hampton teenagers, and they were mentioned, referenced in the report that we published earlier this month. Their names were referenced. And what's interesting about these two individuals is that, let's assume for a moment that they are in fact persons of interest in connection with this inquiry. Let's assume that our information from our network of law enforcement sources is accurate. If they are, this brings us full circle, people, because these were some of the first names that were provided to investigators in that report that we released. But there are multiple Murdoch connections to these individuals. Let's start with the fact how we know their names in the first place. We know their names in the first place because Patrick Wilson's stepfather provided the names to investigators. And the person who told him to tell investigators, Randy Murdoch. Not only that, Randy Murdoch involved in a civil suit against Sean Connolly, the individual who, according to Patrick Wilson, is the one who hit and killed Stephen Smith. Murdoch filed a civil suit on behalf of a client named Christopher Still against Connolly. And then there was another civil lawsuit filed against him in connection with the Murdoch law firm. But beyond that, Wilson, the one who has provided this information, allegedly, according to the report, was facing murder charges in the South Carolina 14th Circuit, which were dropped shortly after this information was provided. So again, a lot of just unexplained connections tied to these two individuals. Now, what is the status of the investigation right now? We know that SLED has said that it's made significant progress, but we've also heard that given how old this case is, that we're dealing with an 8-year-old case, that's going to be very tough to find evidence and witnesses to back up these theories about what may or may not have happened. But one thing is clear. One thing is clear, folks. The Stephen Smith murder investigation, which for years, again, had been completely forgotten almost, off the radar. It came back on the radar in a huge way after the Murdoch murders, came on the radar even more on the Netflix documentary, and now the national attention has just reached a crescendo. And I think we're getting closer to answers, but here's the problem. So many of the investigative leads that are so critical to this case, we don't know if they've been followed up on. For example, the alibis of these two individuals, those who may be able to corroborate or not corroborate those alibis. We've spoken to investigators who have pointed to some serious potential omissions in this ongoing investigation. And let's hope that the State Law Enforcement Division, which recently announced that it was putting new resources into the Stephen Smith case, let's hope it's zeroing in on those leads and that we can finally, at long last, get some clarity in this case, get some justice in this case. Because, folks, the Stephen Smith story, whatever its proximity to the Murdochs, whatever its proximity to the Murdochs, forget that for a second. It's a murder, which means that there are murderers who have yet to be held accountable. That is our goal. Again, we don't care where it leads. We don't care if it leads directly into the heart of that Murdoch family fiefdom that ruled the Lowcountry for over a century, or we don't care if it leads elsewhere. What we care about is finding where it leads. And that's what Fitz News has been focused on from the beginning, and that is what we will continue to focus on as we release more Stephen Smith files in the days and weeks to come. Keep it tuned to FitzNews.com, again, for the very latest on the Stephen Smith murder investigation. All right, so for this segment, we're standing outside the Supreme Court in downtown Columbia, South Carolina, and we're here because I wanted to talk about an issue this news outlet has been hammering on for years. If you followed Fitz News for any period of time, you know we care about justice. We care about victims. We care about public safety. We care about creating a court system here in South Carolina where everyone is treated fairly, no matter how much money they have and no matter who their attorney is. That's the system South Carolina needs, but it's not the system South Carolina has. And the reason? Because South Carolina is one of only two states in the entire country where the legislature appoints judges. It's actually worse than that in our state, though. In South Carolina, a handful of lawyer legislators are responsible for screening judicial candidates, which means that they get to pick who runs for judicial positions, not just who wins. The entire system is rigged, folks, and the result has been injustice across the board and a huge rise in violent crime in the Palmetto State as violent offenders are repeatedly turned back onto our streets. Now, this week in Columbia, South Carolina, a group of law enforcement leaders and prosecutors gathered in the office of South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson to propose change to this system. Now, what do they propose? Unfortunately, not a whole hell of a lot. Over the last few years, this news outlet has pushed for a number of different solutions. We've talked about public election of judges. We've talked about governors appointing judges and then having the public decide through elections whether to retain them. We talked about all sorts of fundamental structural reforms to this system, but none of those were on the table at this week's big press conference. Now look, I appreciate Attorney General Alan Wilson putting this issue back on the forefront of the public's radar. That matters. Credit to his office and credit to all of the solicitors and the law enforcement leaders who showed up. But folks, this press conference was a missed opportunity. This was an opportunity to call for substantive reform to a badly broken system. But what we ended up with was some of the strongest men in this state literally standing up and saying, please give us a seat at the table, lawmakers. Please let us have a voice in this process. That's not what we need, people. And also, I want to point out, those prosecutors and law enforcement leaders were very, very deferential to the General Assembly. Frankly, they should have called those lawmakers out because it is their votes in support of this failed system that have perpetuated the ongoing injustice that we see in South Carolina. They should have been mad. They should have been angry. And I want to point something else out. One of the prosecutors who stood up at that press conference said that we had to push for these small-scale reforms because bigger ticket reforms would take years. Well, you know what? Some of us have been arguing for years in support of those big ticket reforms. So maybe if some of the folks who attended that press conference had stood up earlier, maybe we would be further down the road than we are now. Now, unfortunately, what this news outlet has learned is that the only reform of judicial selection in South Carolina that's currently on the table is for the executive branch of government to have a few seats on this screening panel called the Judicial Merit Selection Commission, which is responsible for picking our judges. The legislature will still control the panel, people. They will still hold a majority of seats. What does that mean? I'll tell you what it means. It means nothing is going to change. And not only that, this reform, not even going to happen until next year. Now, I don't know about you, but that, to me, is totally unacceptable. Totally unacceptable. We have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity here to fix a system that has been broken for so long, that is so corrupt, so incestuous, and so detrimental to victims, to public safety, to fairness. And if we squander that opportunity on half measures, just so some politicians can have their pictures taken in the newspaper, pretending to do something about the issue, no. That is not the reform South Carolina needs. I want to be perfectly clear on something. As long as Fitz News is standing out in front of these issues, we will continue to push for the real reforms that will fundamentally change, not tinker around the edges, of the way judges are chosen in South Carolina. All right, folks, we're outside the South Carolina Statehouse in the shadow of Strom Thurmond, the memorial here on the south steps of the Statehouse. We're with Candace Carroll. Candace, you were good enough to come down to Walterboro when we were covering the Murdoch trial.
Yes, yes.
So now we're back in our regular surroundings.
Thank you for having me again. I appreciate it.
No, absolutely. You did great talking about all those issues down there in Walterboro. Gave us a much-needed break from that trial. Mm. But let me ask you this. Before we get into all the issues here at the Statehouse that we're going to talk about, I want to ask you a little bit about the work that your group is doing, Americans for Prosperity. You guys had a recent day of action down in Somerville, was it?
We did, yes, absolutely. So we are looking to talk to voters all across the state, right? We know that 2024 is coming up. It's a big year across the country, big year in South Carolina. South Carolina is known for picking the president on both sides, right? And so what we are doing right now is we are going to the doors and talking to voters to figure out what issue is it that is the most important to them as they think ahead to next year. Families are being crushed by inflation. I think about Easter coming up. You got to pay $9 for a carton of eggs. What people can do for their Easter lunches. Can they dye Easter eggs with their kids? What's going on there? Gas prices have been just so fluctuating so much over the past few years. And then we also have, you know, healthcare coming out of COVID with the national state of emergency supposed to be ending in May. We have, you know, education that really, I think, caught fire during COVID, where parents wanted to lean more into their kids' education choices. So we are trying to identify just across the aisle, what is it that is that burning issue for people that they're thinking about as they go, you know, potentially to the polls next year. And so we are looking to drive out voters, you know, on those issues in particular. And what we saw last week, so our National Day of Action in Somerville, we had over 50 volunteers come out. We knocked all day from 9 a.m. to 5 all across Somerville. And really what bubbled to the top was inflation and the economy. Oh, people are being crushed so much by what's going on, and they want someone who can help to steer that ship in the right direction to cut back on the wasteful spending that we see in Washington all the time. Both parties are guilty of it, and cut back on some of the spending that's happening here too, right? And so reining in that earmark spending, we know that families have to live checkbook to checkbook. Congress should have to do the same thing. They shouldn't just be able to write blank checks. Here in South Carolina, we shouldn't be giving, you know, tax incentive credits to big companies to come into the state.
Not just small,
$1 million worth of incentives, especially when there's a $3.5 billion missing that we can't even find. So looking to lean into those issues. So we are knocking all across the state. So we started in the first congressional, actually at the end of April, we'll be knocking up in Greenville for our National Day of Action there to see, like, are the issues consistent from congressional district to congressional district? And what does that look like? Or do those issues vary as we move across the state? So really excited. We would love for you to join us. It's a fun time. The weather's perfect in South Carolina absolutely. Right now to get outside.
And this is part of a nationwide effort.
It is. Yes. So what we are looking to lean into nationwide is, again, talking to all of these voters. A lot of folks feel disenfranchised with the system. They feel like it's rigged against them. We saw a lot of that bubble up last year during the 2022 election, and even more so in 2020 for the presidential, where people just feel like, why should I even go vote? Like, it's rigged against me. It doesn't matter, but it does matter. And if you don't go vote, someone else will go vote, right? And so I'm really encouraging folks to get out to the polls all across the country. And take back our democracy, frankly. I mean, it's just so political on both sides, so divisive. It doesn't have to be that way. And so where there's an opportunity to try to really drive that message to come together and say, you know, Congress just doesn't need to be yelling at each other from across the chamber. We don't need to have so much divisiveness going on here either. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to come together to get transformative issues done for our state and for our country.
Well, it sounds from like the people knocking on doors, sounds like folks of all, on all points of the political spectrum are focusing on some of the same issues.
They are.
Why are the politicians not following suit?
Why are they not? Yes, exactly. Why are they not following suit? And what we saw too, that I think was just so interesting, is, as you know, here in South Carolina, we have open primaries. So we're talking to voters across the political spectrum to try to figure out what it is that they're concerned about. And inconsistently, it was the same thing. We heard stories of, well, I am buying my groceries in bulk because I can't afford to go to the grocery store on a weekly basis. Or, you know, from someone who told me, hey, I have a a relative who works at Boeing who said they can build the plates, but they don't have the diesel to fly them, right? And then you're driving up and down the interstate and you're seeing all the bags on the gas station handles again, or people are out of gas. So, you know, people are very concerned about what's going on, and they're having to make really tough choices that our elected officials should have to be making as well.
And this is an ongoing, you were talking about the national component of this, started in 2022.
Yes.
Continuing into this election cycle. And I read a memo from your national director talking about how the goal of this was to get better candidates.
Yes.
So the voters have better choices.
Yep.
Is that really what
it is? It is, absolutely. And so, again, this goes back to the polarization. We see people who are going into their primaries and really leaning so far onto, you know, the extremes of both sides. And that's not helpful, in that it doesn't allow for good policy to be made when they get into office, because then they don't want to work with people, you know, across the aisle from them. So we want to see better candidates rise up. We are looking to get engaged, frankly, at the primary level, at all levels of in 2024.
So
yes.
Not just State House.
So we will be, we've engaged in the primary, our sister organization has, AFP Action, in some congressional primaries here in South Carolina previously. But yeah, we're looking to get engaged at the primaries at all level next year. And so this is really helping to figure out what is that policy narrative that should be driving those primary election decisions for voters.
Well, speaking of policy, let's talk about some of the policy moves here in the building behind us this year. Hasn't been a good year for the South Carolina General Assembly, has it?
No, I think that there's, I was cautiously optimistic at the beginning of session.
Always a mistake.
But I think that there is some stuff that has gotten across the aisle from one chamber to the other, right? A lot that is still left to be desired in some areas. And then in other areas, it'll be interesting to see, now that the legislation has crossed over. We have the Senate crossover was just yesterday. The House crossover is next week.
Great question. It's basically a limitation on which bills can be moved from one chamber to another.
Yeah. So where the bills originate. So as a Senate bill originates in the Senate, of course, and the House will in the House. So they have to get it out of their chamber by a certain deadline in session for it to essentially be alive and get I would say priority in the other chamber, essentially, is what it's for. So the Senate worked, you know, through yesterday to get their Senate originated bills over, which meant that some House bills that had already moved to the Senate, some that are on the Senate floor calendar, have not yet been taken up because they wanted to get through those Senate originated bills first.
If they don't meet this deadline, what happens?
Then it's very difficult to get it through.
Like,
right?
One person can stop
that. Correct. And then in the Senate, that could already happen.
Right.
And so then you need to take it up with like a special order vote or something after this crossover date in order to get it to the other chamber. And this is just the start of our 2-year session. So bills that didn't make that crossover deadline this year are not, I would say, dead forever, but
dead till next year,
oh, wow. Essentially. Yes.
Now, is this deadline we're talking about, let's talk about some of the bills that did make it through. Mm-hmm. One of them is an issue that's been very important to your organization, getting rid of this certificate of need, this
yes.
government-run regulatory regime over healthcare in the Palmetto State. Tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about the status of that bill. I know we talked about it the last time you were on.
Yeah, so I think even before I came down last time, the State House so far, so that bill passed the Senate in early February, frankly, which is what we saw happen last year too. That bill is now with the House 3M committee. Mm-hmm. The 3M committee held a public hearing. They took 3 hours of testimony last month. And so now we have just been waiting on another subcommittee hearing where they can actually take a vote on the bill. So that's kind of where we are, is in this holding pattern in the House.
It's troubling, though, isn't it?
I think so, yes. And so we saw this last year happen where the Ways and Means Committee took the bill up and then sat on it and sat on it and sat on it, and then it got to the end
doing
of the committee.
Same thing. It looks like it.
I hope not. But yes, that's what it looks like. But again, we have this crossover deadline coming up. The bill made it out of the Senate, which is promising, and it's in the House. The House is going to rush to get their House bills done. So I have been told that it would come up after crossover, which is next week in the House, and then the House takes furlough again. So we're looking at like the middle of April before it would potentially come up in the House, which gives us about a month to get it out.
So they stalled on this during the last session,
mm-hmm.
and we're waiting on them still to take action.
Folks
who want more healthcare choices, who mm-hmm. want lower healthcare bills,
What do they need to do?
Contact your House member directly. I would say, in particular, I would contact, if your House member's on the 3M committee, I would give them a call and figure out, ask them to ask their chair when there's going to be a committee hearing, and really look to put that pressure on your House member and say, what is the deal with this? This has passed the Senate two times in a row, overwhelmingly passed the Senate. It's, you know, it's not like it was a narrow margin. And now it's in the House. Again, the House did a public hearing already. They heard 3 hours of testimony from all sides, from patients, physicians, parents, you know, kind of across the board, hospital CEOs. But now we're in this waiting game again. What I think, though, is where I would say I'm more optimistic than last year is that the chairwoman of 3M, Celeste Davis, has traditionally been very favorable towards repeal. And okay. She has filed her own bills in the past.
She wants to get rid of.
She wants to get rid of. Correct. Okay. Correct. So traditionally, she has been very much in favor and has had her own repeal bills out there. This year, as the chairwoman, she does not, but she has been very favorable towards taking the bill up and giving it that public hearing, which we did not see last year as much. They kind of waited until the last minute to let people come testify. The subcommittee chairman, Mark Smith, also tends to be favorable towards repeal. There are a number of members on the committee, so I think it's a matter of, like, not if they take it up, but when they take it up, and then what does that final product look like, and will the Senate concur with whatever changes the House puts in, or will it go to conference? So still a lot to come on Certificate of Need, and I am choosing to remain cautiously optimistic. We will get something done this year.
I want that cautious optimism in my life. let's go to another health-related issue. A few days ago in the State Senate, there was a very emotional moment. State mm-hmm. Senator Tom Davis of mm-hmm. Beaufort took the well and really chastised, not by name, but chastised several of his colleagues mm-hmm. in the Senate for stabbing him in the back mm-hmm. on the issue of medical marijuana. This is a bill that's cleared the Senate before, mm-hmm. and then, of course, we've been talking about this. This seems to be a trend.
Yeah.
These bills clear in the Senate, then they get stalled or procedurally blocked in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. But tell us, first of all, where's your group AFP on this issue of legalizing marijuana for medical purposes, and give us a little update on what's exactly happening with this bill.
Yeah, great question. And we are very supportive, and we have been in years previously. We actually joined a press conference earlier this week with a number of veterans from across the state who were speaking out in favor of medicinal cannabis. And so, as you mentioned, the bill, again, passed the Senate last year. It was about a 2-1 vote passing it out of the Senate. This year, it got pulled out of medical affairs, so didn't get the committee or subcommittee hearings, which I was fine with. I mean, it was the same bill that passed last year. There's one change to it, and that was the tax piece, which was ruled out of order based off of the House rulings last year. So that piece is no longer in the Senate version of the bill, and so the rest of it remains the same. It got pulled out to the Senate floor, and then it has just kind of sat there. And so Senator Massey, a couple weeks ago, went to make a motion for a special order, which basically means that that bill would get precedent over any other bill that they're going to take up in the Senate.
They pushed it out.
They could push it out, yes. But that special order motion failed with a 20-20 split, which was very interesting because members who were supportive of the underlying bill voted no on giving it a special order vote. Some of the members who allowed for it to move out of the Medical Affairs Committee in the Senate voted no on a special order vote, even after they had voted to have it pulled out of committee. And so I think you could have heard a pin drop over there. It was so quiet. A Senate went into executive session immediately, closed door session, to try to figure out what are we going to do with this bill. So I'm very grateful to Senator Davis for charging forward. And what we saw a few days ago, or you mentioned, he took the well, and then a number of his colleagues, one after another, took the well right after him and said, this is the same bill that we passed last year. There's no reason not to move it. What's the problem? And so that bill, unfortunately, did not make crossover this year, since it needed to have made it yesterday. But again, it's a bill the Senate could still potentially take up and move it over to the House, and it would be sitting in the House next year whenever they come back. It just would mean it's not necessarily going to be like a priority status bill for the House to take up later this year if the Senate decides to actually punch it out. What I think is so interesting and would encourage you to do is reach out to your senators and figure out, especially if they were a yes vote on the bill last year, which you can find on the State House website, how they all voted, give them a call and say, what happened?
Yeah.
Like, has your stance changed? Or, you know, why were you a no on special order? Because you can find that vote on the State House website too. Like, what happened this year? And, you know, how can we move forward with this bill and provide that much needed relief to patients across the state?
Let me ask you a question. This leads into my next question about this pressure that's starting to, at long last, come down on these Republican supermajorities. Mm. I use that Republican loosely here in the South Carolina General Assembly. We're talking about these terms, crossover deadlines, setting bills for special order. These are procedural terms that most folks probably don't understand.
Right.
But are these lawmakers using that? Because a lot of these lawmakers are going back to their districts and saying, oh, I'm for medical marijuana. I've always voted for it. Well,
right.
But these votes you're talking about, these procedural votes, they're not for it.
They're not for it. Right. So the procedural votes matter. And we saw that last year in the House, too, on medical cannabis in particular, where on that procedural ruling, where Tommy Pope was at the well, he made the ruling that he did, and then there was an opportunity to appeal the ruling of the chair. And there were members who had told us and others that they were in favor of the bill, told their constituents they were, but then they didn't, you know, how they voted on that procedural ruling was different in some ways. And sometimes it's a, I don't want to go against, you know, what the speaker wants or what the, you know, whoever's in, at the well wants. But I would pay attention to the procedural rulings because I think it's interesting. Sometimes you have members who will vote to send a bill back to committee, even though they say like, hey, I'm for this bill, or they don't vote for special order for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's their own bills aren't moving and they're trying to make a point, or sometimes it's they feel that if they took a vote on it, they go back to their constituents, you know, maybe it wouldn't be favorable among their constituencies, which on medical cannabis is interesting because, and I don't buy that argument, because over 76% of South Carolinians are in favor of medical cannabis.
Oh, yeah.
So to say my constituency isn't on board,
I
think it's crazy. Yes.
Kentucky just
passed it. Yes. And so for us to say that we are pro medical freedom and that we are a pro-military and veteran state, like the votes don't reflect that, which I think is interesting and something that people should really pay attention to.
Well, I want to thank you for bringing these procedural gimmicks that these folks are using to the attention of our audience. I think it's so important because, again, these politicians are going back and telling their people, oh, we're with you, we're for you, but no.
Right.
When these little votes, these procedural votes and these deadlines.
And they happen quick too, right? Like you're watching session and whether you're in the State House or you're watching online, those procedural votes come up. And if you don't know what it's for, like it happens really quickly. And sometimes the special order votes are not roll call votes. So you can't know exactly how folks voted. On the medical cannabis bill though, there was a roll call vote that was called. And so you can go back and get the 2020 split and see how your lawmaker voted on that.
We're actually gonna get that and put that up on the screen now for folks who care about that issue. We're gonna pull that vote and let you take a look at it right here. Speaking of things that it's easy to miss, something that to me would seem to be hard to miss in a state where the annual budget is about $32 billion would be a $3.5 billion accounting
error. Right, right.
Typical South Carolina, here we are.
Yeah.
Our state's Comptroller General missed a $3.5 billion. He called it an anomaly.
Right.
That's the term.
Which this error has been going on for years for it to grow to $3.5 billion. It wasn't just an overnight error. I think it's interesting and something we've been calling for years. And there's been a bill filed here by Representative Elliott in previous years and by Senator Talley in previous years is calling for a taxpayer checkbook where people could go online, and Ohio has this and it's very impactful. You could go online and see how your tax dollars are being used down to the penny. And the way Ohio does it as well is not just like their state budget, but theirs drills down into their school board budgets to see how funding is being used. That's something we have advocated for years. And again, if South Carolina families are having to live paycheck to paycheck, and here our Comptroller General missed a $3.5 billion error in the budget that was found by one of his staffers, and kudos to her for bringing it to everyone's attention, because I think for that massive error to go against your boss, go public with this. She's had to sit and testify at the State House with her boss in the room about how she found this. I mean, tremendous kudos. Yeah, painful, but tremendous kudos to her for bringing it forward and not staying silent on the fact that she found this error. What I think is interesting, and I saw your article on the Scouts Motor issue, is, you know, we are continuing to give out tax incentives and tax credits as a state to try to attract businesses here to the tune of $1.5 million. And I think we just need to be really cautious. One, we're against tax credits and incentives in general, but two, do we even have the money? I don't know if we've got a $3.5 billion error, but the General Assembly seems confident that we do, you know, with what they're handing out to scouts. So I think it's something for people to tune into more and to call for, you know, a change in how we track the budget here. We did see the comptroller resigned recently, effective, I think, later this month. So that race will be interesting to watch to see who they put into that spot.
And that's a legislative decision.
Yes.
A lot of folks think, well, there's a special election and a vacancy that we get to vote on. No, that's not how it works.
Right.
The lawmakers get to pick. So they appear to have zeroed in on one of their former members, Kirkman Finley, a former state representative from here in the Columbia area. He seems to have a lot of support as that election gears up, but still, obviously, we've got some time.
It's not
the end of April that vote will come down.
Yeah, what I think is interesting there, too, is you're seeing this divide between the House and the Senate on who they want to put into this spot. So, of course, some of the House members have put in Kirkman Finley's name. On the Senate side, they're looking to put up an accountant. And so, you know, Finley is a businessman and very successful in the Columbia area for people who aren't familiar with him. But I think it's interesting. You even have the governor coming out and saying, we want someone who there's no political ties. There's, you know, that has a strong accounting and economic background. So I think that race will be one, and I say race in quotes because again it's decided over here, but it'll be interesting to see what actually comes of that and how, especially given this error, how the General Assembly decides to prioritize what credentials they're looking for someone to put into that particular office.
And it is worth noting, though, the last guy who lost the $3.5 billion, he did have an accounting.
He did. So, he did. That's true. That's true. It's not a fail-safe, but you never know. Yeah.
Candace, this is amazing. I want to thank you again for coming on.
Of course.
Every time you come on, we learn something new about this process. Will you? I know I asked you last time, you agree. Would you agree to come on again?
Yes, absolutely. Anytime. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
She's the State Director for Americans for Prosperity here in South Carolina. Thank you for all you're doing.
Of course.
For having me on again.
Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Awesome.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. I want to encourage you, while we're talking politics, check out the Fitz News Palmetto Political Stock Index. A lot of big developments on that this week, given the indictment. Yeah, that's right. The indictment of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Hush money paid a former porn star to keep quiet about an affair several years ago. Apparently, those chickens have come home to roost for the former president. But how will that impact his standing amongst the Republican electorate in South Carolina? We're going to detail that in our Palmetto Political Stock Index. So if you haven't seen that, be sure to check it out. Also, I want to update folks on a story we're covering out of Georgia, the Trent Lehrkamp story. This is one of the most awful cases we've studied. A 19-year-old Georgia teen, folks, who has been tortured by some miners down there in St. Simons Island, Georgia. This news outlet was one of the first outlets to cover that story on the national level. Also, the first outlet to call it what it was, which was torture. We're going to make plans to cover this story in even more detail in the months to come, but I did want to point out that Trent Lehrkamp is out of the hospital, we're told, and that it is on the road to recovery. That is good news. However, we're going to dig into the family situation, some other dynamics that put Trent Lehrkamp in this terrible position where he was, again, tortured by these teens. We're also going to continue to push authorities in Georgia to do their job and hold those responsible for that torture accountable. So stay tuned for much more on that story in future episodes of The Week in Review.